KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
For me, he was Mel. He was this very fine actor, and then the alcohol came and stuff. So when I heard those tapes, I cried. They were kind of shocking to me.
When director George Miller launched the Mad Max series with Mel Gibson, he could not have anticipated the troubles that lay in store for his star. But he did see signs of a tortured soul. Now Oscar-nominated for the newest version of Mad Max, with Tom Hardy as the lead, Miller takes us through his eclectic career. Mad Max, Witches of Eastwick, Lorenzo's Oil, and Babe. He tells us how Jack Nicholson taught him to stay calm when surrounded by Hollywood crazy. But first on the news banter, the major guilds have spoken, and their best picture choices leave us guessing. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, who has a slight affliction of the voice, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Can you say hello, Matt?
I can. Sorry for my painful voice, but it's getting better.
Good. Get better. So it is now time to vote, finally, for the Oscars. We've had an endless buildup, and ballots are out and can be now sent back in. The major guilds at this point have all weighed in, the ones that people look to be predictive: the Producers Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild. And we've talked before about how this is not the clearest race we've ever seen by a long shot, and the guilds did not help with that.
No, I mean, usually this time of year, you see a coalescing around one and possibly two movies in the guild races. But with the Directors Guild going for Alejandro Iñárritu for The Revenant, and the Screen Actors Guild instead going for the cast of Spotlight, and the Producers Guild going for The Big Short, you've essentially got a three-way split here among the major predictive guilds. And who knows whether that's indicative of what the Oscars are going to do or whether they're going to go their own way.
Yeah, the Directors Guild is usually looked to as the predictor, in which case Revenant would be considered the front runner. However, in the past, it's not always true. And most recently, this happened actually as recently as 2 years ago, when the Producers Guild went for 12 Years a Slave and Gravity, which supposedly tied, kind of unusual. The Screen Actors Guild went for American Hustle, and the Directors Guild went for Gravity. And I think we all knew it was 12 Years a Slave or Gravity at that point. But this year, we don't know. It's certainly at least a three-way race. And the other nominees don't seem to be as much in contention. But who knows? You know, there's strange mathematics with those ballots and how you rank your pick.
Yeah, there's other factors. Like, you know, I think there's a lot of sentimentality around The Martian just because Ridley Scott was snubbed for director. So I could see that making a strong push at the end. You know, a lot of people love Brooklyn, and there's a great big below-the-line support for Mad Max, which is a technical achievement as much as anything. So I would not be surprised if it comes down to those three that we mentioned, but you never know.
Yeah, you sort of feel like almost anything could happen. And of course, now, certainly for two of these three movies, which are very socially of today, well, all three of them, really, these three front runners, they're all sort of pulling these stunts. You know, this is the Harvey Weinstein bag of tricks, where you try to make it clear that this film, whichever one it is that you're pushing, is the one that has the most social relevance. Of course, you have, you know, when you have the Boston church pedophilia scandal up against the collapse of the housing market and the, you know, the whole financial crisis of 2008, it's a tough contest. They're both very relevant to the world today. And of course, The Revenant is trying to sneak in there and be relevant in the world today, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost hilarious, the emails that we get from the backers of both Spotlight and The Big Short, pointing us to different important things they've done. The Big Short director, Adam McKay, went to Washington twice for screenings. You know, there have been op-eds and pieces in USA Today and all these things about how the movie is relevant to the issues of today. You know, then you saw the Spotlight people actually manage to get they say it's coincidental. There was a commission opened at the Vatican to look into priest abuse that comes, you know, during this key period of voting. Leonardo DiCaprio himself met with the Pope a few weeks ago. not to talk about the Revenant, but to talk about the environment. And, you know, I think a cynical person looks at these things and says, okay, this is part of a concerted effort to make these films feel important so that when Oscar voters are deliberating amongst films they like equally, maybe the one that is going to do some change and make a difference is the one they vote for, because everyone in Hollywood wants to make a difference.
Yeah, I'm sure when people were watching The Revenant, they were just thinking, wow, the environment looks so pristine. I really hope that this can go forward and this movie will inspire people. Meanwhile, let's segue from The Big Short to the stock market of today, which has been doing a lot of gyration.
The Big Short in Hollywood.
The Big Short in Hollywood is underway. The media stocks are getting beaten. And, you know, the fact is Wall Street is falling out of love with these companies because obviously the model is under challenge. And I think a lot of people have confidence that there will still be entertainment and hopefully people will still pay for it. It may not be as much money as people have been used to mopping up because digital does not compare with analog, as we know. But it's interesting that Disney, which just killed it, certainly at the movies, you know, with the Star Wars movies and the rest of their bag of goodies, the Pixar and Inside Out, got hurt again because of ESPN.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of a weird thing about how the stock market operates independently from the real world, because if you look at Time Warner and especially Disney, their financials were pretty good this quarter, and especially with the parks and with the Star Wars movie for Disney, they're doing fine, but it's this long-term outlook of cord cutting and the weakness in subscriber numbers at the cable networks, which have powered these conglomerates for so many years. That's what investors are looking at. And irrespective of the chaos at Viacom, I mean, that's its own separate animal, and no one knows what the heck is going on there. And their stock is down, you know, 40-something percent this year. I think that the overall cord-cutting fears are what are hurting Hollywood, and it's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm going to just run through some of these companies. Time Warner down 31% since August. Fox down 29%. Disney down 27%. That's just a sample. And the champion is, of course, Viacom. We saw an earnings call from Viacom. The news continues to be bad. Philippe Domon recently, as we've discussed, not just a CEO, but now chairman of that company, as Sumner Redstone has been set aside from these roles at Viacom and CBS. Philippe Domon, in this earnings call, he was very aggressive about defending himself and the vision for the company that he claims to have, and saying that the naysayers are wrong, and the stock promptly dropped more than 20%, because I don't think that Wall Street felt the same way.
Yeah, rule number one is usually when you lash out at the people covering your company, the analysts and everyone, the stock probably is not going to react positively. But they're just looking at the financials here, and they're looking at the leadership. And, you know, Viacom, more so than some of the other conglomerates, has been focused on the youth market with MTV, with VH1, with Comedy Central, Nickelodeon. A lot of their assets are targeted towards the exact demographic that is switching from the linear television to digital. And investors right now are not confident that Viacom has made that transition to digital or is showing signs of a strategy to do so, despite the fact that Viacom just announced a partnership with Snapchat to sell advertising and, you know, share those advertising contacts with them. Right now, investors are not buying it.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter.
In this wasteland, I am the one who runs from both the living and the dead. A man reduced to a single instinct. Survive.
That's Tom Hardy as the tortured and taciturn hero of Mad Max Fury Road, the latest entry in the Mad Max series, directed by our guest, George Miller. Miller made the first Mad Max in Australia the better part of 40 years ago. Since then, he's had a successful and exceptionally varied career directing the supernatural dramedy The Witches of Eastwick and the heart-wrenching medical drama Lorenzo's Oil. He wrote and produced the Babe movies, directing one of them, and won an Oscar for the animated penguin film Happy Feet.
Well, today we begin with the most important lesson you will ever learn at Penguin Elementary. Does anyone know what that is? Anyone? Anyone? Someone? Seymour?
Fishing?
No. Mumble?
Don't eat yellow snow.
No, that's not it, no.
It's our heart song, miss.
Thank you, Gloria. Excellent, yes.
Growing up in Australia, Miller's plan was to become a doctor, and he went to medical school in Sydney.
Just as I was graduating, I got involved in making my first film, and that's was kind of diverging path that I took, always intending to be a doctor, but then I kept making movies.
So aside from the medical aspect of Lorenzo's Oil, I don't know if being a doctor has helped you at all. You've dealt with some serious crazy in your career in the movie business, beginning with Witches of Eastwick. I don't know if that was really the beginning of the crazy, but that is a historically crazy shoot, you know, where I guess initially Susan Sarandon was mad at Cher because she thought she had usurped her role, and then Jack Nicholson gets into the middle of it and is constantly stirring the pot with the cast. And I mean, it was just madness.
Well, it was a strange situation because I had only worked in Australia. And then I made part of that Twilight Zone movie. I was invited by Steven Spielberg and an extraordinary group of people. There was Frank Marshall and Kathy Kennedy and Joe Dante and John Davison and just a whole bunch of really, really interesting people. And it just felt like incredibly comfortable. It was just, well, I won't say film school, but it was just a group of people interested in making films.
Serious people who know how to be serious.
Yeah.
I mean, have fun, but also do the work.
Yeah. So pretty soon after that, I went on to Witches of Eastwick thinking, oh, well, you know, Hollywood's not so bad, all the stories. So the film wasn't very well cast in terms of the crew and the personnel working behind the screen. But the big gratitude I have from that film is Jack Nicholson, because he was the one that really held the film together.
Stirred the pot and simultaneously.
Well, he stirred the pot in a way that was very strategic. He basically had to say, look, everyone's got a different agenda. Some agendas are incoherent. So we have to – it's ultimately about the work. Jack, you know, for whatever people think of his public persona, is an incredibly wise man. I remember he said to me, you're not just getting an actor. You're getting someone who's going to help get the film made. And he was so true to his word. He would turn up on off days to do off-camera lines for the other cast. It's such a long time ago, but it's telling me that be careful that they don't mistake politeness with weakness. And really, really kept me in the film because I was happy to leave the film.
I heard you quit several times and he brought you back.
And the interesting thing was that, you know, if you did – which I'd never, ever done, not turn up to set. Suddenly people were paying attention to all the problems that I saw. So I was being rewarded for bad behavior.
Right.
That was so bizarre.
They were positively reinforcing.
Seeing the bad behavior, I thought, gee, if I stick around in this environment too long, I'm just going to become bring out the worst part of myself. So I went back to Australia and didn't direct for a while until Lorenzo's Oil. I produced. Boy,
yes,
you're bringing
I read
back all
that.
Those memories. Yeah.
That's what we do here. We just stir up the memories.
But I thought I went from a worst-case scenario. I haven't experienced that type of thing before.
So did you say to yourself, okay, I don't know what the break was between Witches and Lorenzo's Oil, how long it was. But did you say?
It was 5 years.
I took a five-year break, and now I'm back in this lunatic environment?
Well, No. Lorenzo's Oil, it was like a mission from God. The studio had agreed to put money into the research.
Which was really not a thing that studios then would do.
No,
they responded
to the story.
Because it was a sad movie about a child who gets sick.
They responded to the movie. I remember Tom Pollock. And we had to do the movie fairly quickly. We wrote it quickly because we kind of bought into the ticking clock. And there's always something on a film, but in this case it wasn't as crazy as Witches of Eastwick at all.
And that I got stands in a category by itself.
You know, produce other films and and sort of enjoyed that, but mainly back in Australia.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of a through line between Lorenzo's Oil and Babe and Mad Max. I mean, it's their stories. I got that much.
Yeah, there's got to be story. Story is privileged above everything else. But it's also going to be combined with some sort of tool or something relatively new. So that in the case of the pig movies, how do you make a pig talk? The interesting thing was that if you have kids, you don't get out much anymore in terms of going spontaneously to the movies. So you're tending to watch a lot of family movies. You're going with your kids. So obviously my mind was primed for those sort of things. So when I read something like The Sheep Pig, which became Babe, I saw that it was a fully formed piece and it would be really interesting, not for cell animation. It wasn't a kinetic movie. But I thought if we can make these animal talks and make the people, you know, make people believe. When you look at it now, because it's a mixture of animatronics, and I think the animation's quite good. And it did win an Academy Award for visual effects, but it looks a bit hokey now. But that
really?
Was
it's
the
perfect early, in my memory.
Yeah, yeah. And then the similar thing on the Happy Feet, always interested in the natural history of penguins. When my friend Andrew Lesney, who passed away last year, he went from the Babe movies as cinematographer to Lord of the Rings, and he showed me the first ever motion capture of Gollum. He came back from New Zealand, and the moment I saw that, I thought, ah, the penguins can dance. So it was, again, that combination. So I'm watching a lot of family movies with my kids. My mind is there, and now my kids have grown up, and I go back to what I did.
At the very beginning. Yeah, yeah. Mad Max. Now, Mad Max, wow, that took a long time to come together, this version, this installment of it.
We wrote it last millennium. we were to shoot in 2001, and it was to be with Mel Gibson. And when 9/11 happened, the American dollar dropped significantly against Australian dollar. We lost about 25% of our budget within a few days. And we just couldn't, you know, the planets didn't align. Already had committed to do Happy Feet and the facilities and everything were available. So I went on to that and then so on and so on. It was basically set up three times and fell away. The last one with unprecedented rains in the center of Australia.
Right. You had to move.
We moved.
So Warner Brothers, did they distribute the original Mad Max? I'm not sure how
Oh, well, long history. They distributed internationally. And of all people, Samuel Ziaka from AIP Pictures released it domestically. And they said, look, if you want it to be seen outside of the big cities on the coast, we have to dub it with American accents. So the entire film was revoiced, and not very well.
Did Mel do it or somebody else?
No, Mel, even though he's born in America. No, some entirely different actor. Yeah. And not only that, Hugh Keyes-Byrne, who plays the toe-cutter, the bad guy in that movie, was from the Royal Shakespeare Company. So he was revoiced with a Southern American accent. And when it was shown in England, all his friends turned up to see him. And when he opened his mouth, it was a different voice coming out. And he's got this beautiful, big, booming voice.
Oh, dear.
So it was wonderful to work with him again at Fury Road after 30 years. He plays the Immortan Joe in this movie. So to answer your question, by the time we got to the second and third, that was all Warner Brothers. So it was always Warner Brothers.
It actually worked, this dubbing, because it made, I mean, I don't know how important it was, but I assume that it made Mad Max into a giant international phenomenon.
Well, it started off, you know, really big in Japan. The Japanese somehow recognized something in this movie, that Max was some sort of samurai type guy on wheels, and you know, there's always this archetypal character. You know, the French call it Westerns on a wheel. So it was always dubbed in foreign languages, and it did best in foreign languages initially.
You anticipated the international market.
Well, it seemed to happen, and it seemed to have the resonances. By the time it got to North America, it was, and England, it looked like a bad spaghetti Western, you know, when the sync isn't that great and so on, and the voices are disembodied. But eventually, I think there was enough people saying, wait a moment, you know, where's the original version? And that was released on DVD here and there. And people said, oh, okay, it's a better film than the dub version.
Coming up after a short break, Miller shares memories of working with Mel Gibson on the original Mad Max films. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer-director-producer George Miller about his film Mad Max: Fury Road, which is up for 10 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Fury Road is a chase movie set in a wasteland where Max forms an uneasy alliance with a small group of women who are trying to escape a tyrannical ruler. In one of the rare quiet moments in the film, Max, played by Tom Hardy, asks their leader, played by Charlize Theron, about the green place that she hopes to find.
How do you know this place even exists?
I was born there.
So why'd you leave?
I didn't. I was taken as a child. Stolen.
So when you're making this version, you're going to originally do it with Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you see in Mel, young Mel, doing the original Mad Max, anything of what was to come? Because I know Mel, I've met him a few times myself, but also everybody who works with him says, you know, there's this incredibly charming, considerate, lovely Mel, and then there's the other Mel.
I didn't see it except for on one occasion. But yeah, there's no question. He's a lovely person and essentially a good person really struggling. And one day I didn't even know that he was Catholic, but when he walked past the church and got angry because he couldn't go to the church because of the Vatican II and longer the Latin Mass and whatever, that was the one time I said, well, you know, why are you so angry? And he said, oh, because, and he explained it to me. But then it went by, and as he became more well-known, he was, I won't say embarrassed by his fame, but it sat uneasily with him. Mm. And I remember, because I remember a couple of times I'd be at an airport with him, and, you know, he got very edgy, and I realized he felt very invaded, where people just wouldn't let, you know, for me, he was Mel. He was this very fine actor, and then the alcohol came and stuff, and so when I heard those tapes, I cried. I just, you know, they were kind of shocking to me. And I remember it was at the time was when I first met Tom Hardy, who had his own issues with drugs from the age of 12. And once he was 22, he became very sober. And I remember he said, you know, whatever Mel went through there, you can bet that he's beating up on himself more than he is others. And that sort of made sense, whether that's part of it. I don't know. It's very, very, very sad. But, you know, since then we've spoken and spent some time together, and he seems to be doing a lot better. He just shot a movie down in Australia and directed. He's a very fine director.
He's tormented, brilliant people, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, when you saw the Golden Globes, and did you know he was going to – I assume you knew he was going to be appearing and then
– No, I didn't.
You did not?
No,
oh,
no,
so no. Then you saw you're in the room and Ricky Gervais is making these comments, which were very Ricky Gervais-like.
Yeah.
Did you just
– I think Mel said, okay, I'm going to face up to it and it'll be part of what I do. And he was invited. Sue Kroll invited him.
This is a Warner Brothers executive.
Yeah. She invited him to the premiere of
Mad Max. You were sitting with him there,
and
we sat next
to each other, which is wonderful because, you know, he responded to the movie very well. And I could tell because he's pretty uncensored and just that sort of energy in the seat and the chuckling and the dig in the ribs and all those sort of things.
Right.
And,
well, that was gratifying,
yeah,
I'm sure.
And Tom Hardy was there on the other side. So, yeah.
So you get to the point finally where this has all come together to do this movie. And you've got Tom Hardy and it's all good. And then you go to Australia and there's this downpour and you can't shoot, or just visually wrong.
It's visually wrong. What was Flat Red Earth?
became for the flowers.
Was flowers. Just, it's waiting there for water.
So you go off to Africa. Of course, it was not easy to shoot there, as I understand it. You fell behind the budget. I mean, obviously the challenges when you see the movie, it's not hard to figure out what was difficult because you didn't use that much CG.
No, it's not a film that defies the laws of physics and flying people or spacecraft or anything. So you had to do it for real. And we shot in a kind of chronology. It was shot atypically because it was based almost entirely on storyboards. There was a script, but a lot of it illustrations. And everything was pretty expected. And the film, with the delays, was very, very well planned. It was just the logistics. I mean, Africa doesn't quite have the infrastructure that you want and so on. But it, in some way, it got osmotically into the fiber of the movie, and I think ultimately it wouldn't have been the movie it is unless that dust and grit and everything was there.
Dust, grit, and apparently Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy got very into character and decided they didn't care for each other that much.
Well, that was certainly there, but remember we shot in chronology, and the very first scene they had to play together was this very, very complex fight where they're basically trying to kill each other.
Right.
And bit by bit, very much like the characters, you know, a positive regard emerged and
they worked it out.
Virtually like the characters. But people have said this is a feminist movie and it's female versus male. But I hope what's apparent from the story is that it's only by them cooperating, having some mutual regard and cooperating.
That line where she says they're not dependable. She says something.
Oh, that she does. She says they're reliable.
Right.
Yeah. He becomes the reliable man.
And that's where the bridge is crossed.
Yeah.
What did Tom Hardy do in his life or his last life, do you suppose, to be in The Revenant and Mad Max, burning up in the desert and freezing in either Canada or somewhere south of the end of Argentina in one lifetime?
Well, no pun, but he's very hardy. He's very physical. And, he played rugby. And just heard an interview where those guys on the poles, you know, that we have.
Which you really did with Cirque du Soleil
people.
Yeah,
really, real people. So some, we need you to do the scene and so on. And it wasn't until he got up there where he actually said, I'm afraid of heights. And I said, have you got one or two takes in you? And he said, yeah, come on, let's do it. And he did those takes. And but in an interview I just heard, he's very, very funny, Tom. And he did this thing where he was almost saying, I was so scared, like a little baby. I'm thinking,
big man.
Yeah, yeah. But, he's up for it.
He's game.
Yeah.
So the single act of courage that is maybe most impressive is that you talked your wife, who is a film editor, into cutting the film.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah.
So what was that like?
Well,
especially since she didn't, I should say, she had said she was not interested in this kind of thing.
Yeah,
right?
She's not, it's not her kind of thing. And that's almost precisely the reason why, because I knew it wouldn't just be following the usual thing. Plus, I know how she does everything with a very high degree of rigor and excellence, even just watching the way she guards. She's a great gardener. Two other things. One is she has a very low boredom threshold, so you cannot be repetitive. And secondly, she's not afraid to tell me what she feels.
Really?
And that was a big bonus. There was no, and it got to the point where that if there was a problem, I began to trust her instinct more than mine, and I found, okay, she's got an idea. I knew the best thing to do was just get up and give her the space in the cutting room. And each time I came back, she found the most elegant solution. And those cumulative through the movie really, I think, in many ways saved our butts.
And now she's got an Oscar, one of the 10 Oscar nominations for the film. I'm going to guess you didn't see that coming.
Definitely not. No, definitely not. Not out there in the deserts of Namibia.
George Miller is the director and co-writer of Mad Max Fury Road. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for the chat.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.